rafter at one edge and then unrolling the rest across the roof, tacking it down as we went. When we reached the far end, I'd cut off the remainder of the roll, and while Peter went back knocking in wooden battens to secure the felt in place, I'd move on up to begin the next one. Blustery weather is not the best in which to work on a roof. We had to crouch close to the surface to stop the wind blowing us off, which made hammering the nails in somewhat awkward. But Peter had a schedule he wanted to keep to. We finished one side of the roof at noon, ate our sandwiches in a hurry, and began the other side. Late in the afternoon, as the light began to fade, I unrolled our last line of felt, tacking it as I went. Peter had climbed down to get some more battens. I reached the far end of the roof, cut the remnant of the roll, and let it drop to the ground far below. All of a sudden, a gust of air came howling up the ravine towards us. It shuddered into the shell of the house, which, with this last line of felt, I had just sealed. Seeking escape, the wind flew up through the building and whipped loose the far end of the roll of felt I'd just tacked down. I watched, horrified, as the felt ripped through the few nails holding it down, rising like some predatory, unfurling tongue towards me. By the time it reached me, the weight of the felt and the speed at which it was moving were going to take me with it off the highest part of the roof. I let go of the tools I was carrying and slid down over the battens below me, just far enough to hear the felt flap past my head and then watch it blow high into the air and ripple off across the sky like a black prehistoric creature. Through February, there were further blizzards and snowdrifts, black ice on ungritted roads. Towns and cities in the eastern counties of England were entirely cut off. Roads were strewn with abandoned cars. On the house-building front, Peter chose the very coldest day of the winter to start glazing the windows. Sheets of glass were delivered, from which he cut each small pane we needed, breath condensing in the air as he mumbled the measurements to himself. It was my job to install the panes, pinning each one in place before securing it with putty. It was too delicate a job to wear gloves, but that frozen day my fingers soon grew numb and became unwieldy. They wouldn't do what they were meant to. The glass panes began to be smeared with blood from cuts I couldn't feel. At some point I noticed a sound which I realised was coming from my own lips, whimpering like a dog from the cold. Peter sent me home, disappointed. The shelves in the village shop emptied as people stocked up on canned food. Waste collection workers went on strike and rubbish piled up outside people's houses. In London, Westminster Council allocated rubbish to be dumped in Leicester Square. The great mounds of it there became infested with rats. The country was freezing and paralysed, but beneath the surface, great change was coming. In our own world, repressed forces stirred. Mark and I and a mutual friend we'd spent our winter evenings with found ourselves entangled in a triangle of unrequited affections. At least two of us had fallen deeply for the wrong person. It all came out as the snow thawed and water began to flow down the hillsides in torrents and gullies. We couldn't carry on. Mark returned to Devon. Within a year, had a serious job, a wife, a child. I soon followed him off the hill and made my way to Oxford, where I would work for the next 10 years as a building labourer and in other manual work while I learned how to write prose, novels engaging with the society we live in. I got to Oxford just in time to vote there in the general election of 1979. The national mood seemed to have equated the winter of industrial unrest with the treacherous weather, as if each had conspired with the other to spread misery across the country. In May, Margaret Thatcher's Conservative Party rode to power to save the wealthy from left-wing madness and to wreak its own brand of havoc. I remember those days of my immature exile when I sweep a chimney or clear a drain with a set of rods I would inherit from my grandfather, who teased me into opening my eyes.
Thank you. That interval talk was presented by Tim Pears and produced in Bristol by Tim D. And a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall, where tonight the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra are visiting with conductor Herbert Blomstedt. Just a single work left on the programme here tonight. It's Bruckner's very last piece, his Ninth Symphony. It was a work that struggled to come into being. Written at the height of Bruckner's powers, he spent 9 years trying to complete this, the final masterpiece, his last word on symphonic music. But the composer died before he could finish the task. Well, Bruckner was a man whose convictions and beliefs were made concrete in his music. His symphonies, often called cathedrals in sound, are monumental statements of personal expression. He was a composer on the edge of the cultural elite. He was appalled at musical trends and fashions, taking little interest in the world beyond music theory. His work steered clear of outside influences. He was a bachelor with a crippling inability with the opposite sex. There were a few rather sad attempts to propose marriage to various girls. He often fell deeply, if unrequitedly, in love. Bruckner's peasant roots, his strict upbringing, his career as a teacher, his failure in love, all of them left their mark on his work. This was a man with the deepest respect for authority, for tradition. He was deferential with an utter dread of any criticism. His scores were impeccably neat, his corrections precise, his ideas explored with patience and unfailing logic. For Bruckner, there was no room at all for cheap sentiment or sensuous passion. But despite that reputation as a conservative, for tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt, Bruckner is the very opposite. In effect, he's almost a proto-modernist.
Bruckner is supposed to be a very simple man, very old-fashioned. In a way, that's also true, but he was a very keen mind. And he was an absolutely honest composer. Every bar is truth, so to speak. He is nothing that is fake. The musical texture and the musical melodies and harmonies have their own laws, and when they lead him into extreme dissonances, he is going that direction. At the climax of the third movement, which is the climax of the whole symphony, it ends with a chord which is so dissonant that you don't believe, and it is painful. Even for the ear, it's even physically painful, like a scream. You cannot say anything. And only after several seconds you can resume, and in a most moving way, Bruckner bids farewell. He was a sick man. He knew he could not complete the finale. And he looks back at some earlier works. It's a moving farewell. The violin satitim pom 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 pim pom, like waving goodbye. It makes a very gripping experience for everyone who plays it and everyone who listens.
Given that the work is so complex, so large, how do you take these very young players to the heart of that? What words do you give them to take them into the heart of Bruckner's music?
I don't lecture them. I think lecture does not help very much. I remember rehearsing this symphony with my orchestra in San Francisco, and one of the very best musicians in the orchestra came to me in the first intermission at the rehearsal and said, "Maestro, was it this music really about?" I couldn't answer her. I told her, "Come back after the performance." She did not come back. She didn't need to. She had got it. You have just to open your ears and use your own intelligence, use your own imagination, open your heart, and the music will speak.
Tonight's conductor, utterly charming and eloquent, Herbert Blomstedt. I was talking to him earlier today. Well, a large piece for which large orchestral forces are required. There's around 114, 115 players on stage. I can't say that I've counted them for you accurately, but that's my best guess. Including 12 double basses. They're banked along the back of the platform, along a riser right at the top, spreading right across the back of the orchestra. kind of musical backbone, if you like, there to underpin the orchestra with those massive, slow-moving, deep bass harmonies that characterise so much of Bruckner's music. So now, joining the players of the Gustav Mahler Jugendorchester, it's tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt, to conduct Bruckner's mighty Ninth Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you. and Tom Bruckner's unfinished Ninth Symphony. A performance here at the 2010 BBC Proms by the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, conducted by Herbert Blomstedt. The orchestra led by the Israeli-British young violinist Shira Epstein. That symphony was a work that its composer never got to hear. Bruckner died in 1896. The first performance of this symphony took place 7 years after that. And just a superb performance by this orchestra. Founded a quarter of a century ago by Claudio Abbado, the first youth orchestra to recruit from both Eastern and Western Europe. Abbado is still their music director. Every year he presides over a panel of judges, 1,500 applications from across Europe to join this band. Really means something to be part of this elite group. And no mean feat to conduct tonight's programme. It's a heck of a thing to perform, but tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt, is in his 80s and just beams at the orchestra. A passionate communicator, wants to bring every last drop of expressive power out of these young players. And a fantastic atmosphere here between all of them in rehearsals. Well, something tells me they're going to get pretty good reviews for this in the papers tomorrow. But these players will not be here to read them. The orchestra's off back to Germany to perform the same programme again. They'll be playing on Friday. It's part of their summer tour. Quite rightly, much stamping of feet here from the audience as they welcome Blomstedt back onto the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, that is it for tonight's concert. Certainly tomorrow night, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales back at the Proms. Programme from them of French music, Rameau, Canteloube, a UK premiere from Martin Matelon, and Henry Wood's arrangement of Mussorgsky's Pictures in an Exhibition. I'll be over on BBC 4 television for that. The concert's also broadcast live, as always, here on BBC Radio 3. But for now, from all of us here at the Royal Albert Hall, it's time to hand you back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Susie, thank you very much. Susie Klein there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom broadcast again here on BBC Radio 3 on Thursday afternoon, the 16th of September at 2 o'clock. That's a fortnight tomorrow. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's Prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer Proms season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to Proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, in 10 minutes' time, David Wallace explores the life and work of humanist scholar John Leyland, who was commissioned by Henry VIII to search through the ancient libraries of all the religious houses of his kingdom and catalogue their literary treasures. This was before the monasteries were destroyed and their manuscripts dispersed. Leyland's Travels is at 10 o'clock. Until then, with plenty of French music in tomorrow night's first Prom to contrast with the Austro-German fair of the last two nights, some French music now. A caprice on Danish and Russian airs by Saint-Saëns. It's from 1887. He'd just agreed to conduct some concerts in Russia in the company of a flautist, an oboist and a clarinetist. And he wrote this caprice to show off his skills as a pianist alongside theirs. The players here, Catherine Quentin, flute, Maurice Bourg, oboe, Michel Portal, clarinet, and the pianist is Pascal Roger. the Caprice on Danish and Russian airs by Saint-Saëns. The players there, Catherine Quentin, flute, Maurice Bourque, oboe, Michel Portal, clarinet, and the pianist was Pascal Roger. And as Susie Klein was saying earlier on, plenty more French music in tomorrow night's first prom, including a suite from Rameau's Dardanus and a selection of Cantaloube's lush and much-loved arrangements of songs from the Auvergne. 7 o'clock start for that first of tomorrow night's proms at the Royal Albert Hall and here on BBC Radio 3. Coming up to 3 minutes past ten, well now on Radio 3 in Leyland's Travels, Professor David Wallace charts the career and travels of one of King Henry's most dedicated yet divided servants, the scholar and topographer John Leyland.
To my sovereign liege, King Henry VIII. Whereas it pleased your highness, upon very just consideration, to encourage me, by the authority of your most gracious commission, in the 35th year of your prosperous reign, to peruse and diligently to search all the libraries of monasteries and colleges of this your noble realm, to the intent that the monuments of ancient writers might be brought out of deadly darkness to lively light.
The antiquarian scholar John Leyland here addresses his liege lord, King Henry VIII, in 1546. For 13 years, he reminds his monarch, he has travelled tirelessly for the king, rooting out ancient texts from monastic libraries the length and breadth of the land in his first phase of travelling, and mentally mapping every inch of Henry's Empire of England and of Wales in the second. Now, as a New Year's gift, he promises to write up everything seen and learned on his laborious journey, including a four-volume history of British writers and an exhaustive description of Henry's kingdom, a book for every shire. But by 1547, before any of this could be realised, John Leyland was insane. Henry was dead, and the monasteries were gone. For me, Leyland's terminal case of writer's block is the most poignant in all English history. Never has a man travelled so far, taking so many notes, to produce so little. To travel with John Leyland is to witness unparalleled changes in English culture and English landscape, as medieval Catholicism yields to the power of a centralised Tudor state. But what does it mean to help destroy the thing you love, to pose as an agent of revolutionary history, while yet dreading or doubting its revolutionary effects? Leyland had honed his New Age literary skills, the perfect training for a Henrician new man, on the banks of the Thames at St. Paul's School.
John Collett, who was the Dean of St. Paul's at the time, conceived a refoundation not just as a practical matter, but with a really strong idea of a kind of education that he wanted to put forward.
The early modern scholar, Brian Cummings, speaking at Leyland's alma mater.
And it was said that only four men could speak or read and write Greek in England in 1500, which is just before the school was founded. But certainly Collett sets up, even in the statutes, that he wants the teaching of Greek as well as Latin literature.
So the idea of a revolutionary break with the past is there in Leyland's education?
It's there in Leyland's education. The whole aim of the school turned from the production of potential priests and ministers to the production of people who can work in government.
One of Leyland's St. Paul's contemporaries became Lord Chancellor and died Earl of Southampton. Thomas Wriothesley, the kind of state servant that Henry liked, turned his hand to everything. Diplomacy, versifying, torture. Leyland followed humanism's gentler path to preferment. In 1533, he pleased Henry mightily by penning verses in very public praise of Anne Boleyn.
He and Nicholas Udall were employed to write Latin verses and to design pageants for a quite elaborate welcome of the new queen, as she was, into London as part of her coronation. There's a surviving drawing by Holbein for the scene of Parnassus, which is one of the bits that Leyland wrote, which is described in Hall's Chronicle rather wonderfully. For there was the Mount Parnassus with the fountain of Helicon, which was of white marble, and four streams without pipe did rise an ell high, and met together in a little cup above the fountain, which fountain ran abundantly, racked Rhenish wine till night. But there's another passage where it's both white and red is on stream in the fountains.
And do we have these verses?
We have the verses that Leyland wrote, yes. This is a 19th century English translation of Leyland's Latin verse. Many had told me that Paris saw fairest forms and all beauty, that is, when tending his flocks on Ida's side. He was for giving with impartial hand the golden apple to golden Venus, to the wrath of Minerva and of Jove's sister, until fair Anna joined the company. He's making a nice connection there between Anne and the Greek goddesses of the Trojan myth. There's certainly a coincidence which surely must be almost a kind of line of causation between doing this work and then getting this commission to go around the libraries.
In Tudor politics, flattery gets you everywhere. It certainly propelled Leyland into his first royally funded set of travels. This early stage of travelling casts him as reference librarian. He lists works for future consultation and seeks texts that might help the king in his great matter of defying Rome and unpicking his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, his first queen. His lifelong devotion to King Arthur, the English monarch who defied and conquered Rome, inevitably drew him to Glastonbury and Wells.
When I was at Glastonbury in Somerset a few years ago, I made a short detour to Wells, hoping I might discover something of remote antiquity.
We're entering Wells Cathedral Library, which is an extraordinarily long space, James Carley.
Yes, one of the longest libraries, I think, certainly intact, and I think probably one of the very few libraries that looks almost the way it would have when John Leyland was here in 1533.
So the library had been magnificently furnished with no small number of books by the bishops and canons of that city in former times. Thomas Bubwith made the east part of the cloister, with the little chapel beneath and the great library over it, having 25 windows on each side of it.
It gives you a very good sense of what kind of library would have been used in the period and the kind of intellectual life the Vicar's Quarrel would have had.
James Carley, the world's leading authority on Leyland, or to North Americans, Leland, has spent a scholarly lifetime pondering Leyland's travels, writings, and motivations.
He's here partly because he's an antiquary. He wants to find early books. He wants to find books by British authors because he's writing basically a proto-Dictionary of National Biography. But that's not what his, as it were, his masters, his employers wanted him to do. He was sent here precisely because his patrons, Thomas Cromwell and the Duke of Norfolk, were concerned about the huge fallout there was going to be from this marriage, which was going to lead to Henry's excommunication. They were putting together the documents that would come out in 1534, the Act of Supremacy, making Henry VIII the supreme head of the church under God in England. And John Leland's job was to find texts that would help in this mission.
The books that weren't marked, we don't have anymore. And so what's going on is a very deliberate process of selection, and Leland was clearly playing an important role in that.
The literary historian Jennifer Summitt has traced the journeys of some of the texts that Leyland marked up and spirited away from monasteries to Henry's newly formed Royal Library.
So that when we go into the British Library, we're seeing the fruits of labors that began with Leyland, which is selecting books from the monasteries, bringing them into the royal collection, and then centralizing them into one national collection.
And anybody who walks into the British Library sees that awe-inspiring glass column with those beautiful ancient books at the center of the library.
That's right, and which is a striking image of books as a centerpiece of a kind of national identity. And we could say that that's what started with Leyland.
Officially, Leyland was searching for books that might please his political masters, but he also dallied with texts that might disturb hardline evangelical reformers, the Tudor heirs of John Wycliffe.
This library, from his point of view as a theologian, was a very interesting library because there were very many books written by people who were anti-Wycliffeite. And if you look at Leland's list of books, most of them are books about the Eucharist. And he is concerned about the Eucharist because Leland is a conservative, unlike his master Thomas Cromwell, and Leland is very concerned about the real presence and terrified of what he sees as a new Wycliffeite threat.
So Leland is a traditional Catholic who believes in the real presence, the actual physical presence of God in the Eucharist.
Yes, and he believed that till the end of his life. A great deal of what has been written about Leland talks about him as a Protestant. He wrote an anti-papal text in 1539, which he had to do. He wrote that when, again, England really had been excommunicated. But you can be anti-pope while still being a good Catholic. I believe that Leland always believed that England would eventually return to Catholicism. And up to 1536, there is no absolute surety that the monasteries are going to fall. When he's coming around to these places, he has no idea that this is the end.
It seems that when the end did come, Leland had trouble accepting it. His late Latin poem called Swan Song, Signia Cantio, describes ruined monasteries along the Thames as if they were still up and running. In the early days of his visits to religious houses, when he arrived to make his exhaustive inventories, Leland, armed with his royal warrant, was often warmly received by monks who were fellow bibliophiles. Glastonbury, the richest monastery in England, seemed fit to endure for 1,000 years.
A few years ago, I was at Glastonbury in Somerset, where the most ancient and at the same time most famous abbey in our whole island is located. By the favour of Richard Whiting, abbot of that place, I had intended to refresh my spirits, wearied by the long effort of my studies, when a burning desire to read and learn inflamed me afresh. This desire, moreover, came upon me more quickly than I thought it would, so I immediately went to the library, which is not open to all, in order to examine most diligently all the relics of most sacred antiquity, of which there is so great a number that it is not easily paralleled anywhere else in Britain. Scarcely had I crossed the threshold when the mere sight of the ancient book struck my mind with an awe or stupor of some kind. Then, having saluted the genius loci, I spent some days searching through all the bookcases with the greatest curiosity.
This is maybe our very last view of a person looking at a monastic library. This is 1533. It's 6 years before the monastery is completely destroyed. He stayed with the abbot, who he describes in the first version of that text as, he said, a real gentleman and my greatest friend. And this would have been a rest stop. He would have been well fed, his horse well watered, but obviously the library is so exciting to him that that's where he went.
Glastonbury is clearly the telos of this first journey, isn't it? It's the place of destination for him.
In a sense, Glastonbury was the key position because he had come during the period when we were leading to the Act of Supremacy, where ancient histories are cited. And as he says right there, this is the place where you would find the material.
And we're looking out from Richard Whiting's abbot's house through the ruined entranceway of his dwelling, and in the distance we can see Glastonbury Tor.
It is particularly poignant, this doorway where he looks up to his great church on the Tor, St. Michael's, is where, 6 years later, he would found himself hanged, surrounded by two junior monks on either side of him, a trinity on the top of a hill. It is especially sad because this was a very old man, a gentleman by all accounts, and a good man. He did not deserve the fate that came to him. It was very hard to find anything irregular about the life at Glastonbury. When they wanted finally to arrest him, and it was determined that this monastery would go, all they could find was, as they said, a counterfeit Life of Becket in print and some papal bulls. That's all they could find. It was almost impossible to catch this man.
But he would have died looking down on the abbey as he knew it.
He would have died looking down on the abbey as he knew it.
Leyland later scratched from his notebook heartfelt references to Abbot Whiting as a truly splendid man and an especial friend. Such prudent erasures and careful marking up of texts continued throughout Leyland's career. At that time, choices of texts and phrases could prove, as Richard Whiting discovered, matters of life and death. Leyland was careful to delete the prefix Sanctus from his own catalogue references to Thomas Becket. As time went by, Leyland must have seemed like an angel of death or harbinger of ruin when arriving at monastery gates. Leyland catalogued marvellous holdings which were then dispersed, the monasteries dissolved. The great abbey of Bury St Edmunds, when first encountered early in his travels, boasted the finest library in the land, some 2,000 books, a vast collection at that time. Bury dazzled like a new Jerusalem.
The sun does not shine on a more beautifully situated town, on a monastery more famed for its endowments, size and splendour. There are so many gates, some of brass, so many towers, and a church unsurpassed by any other, that it makes you think you were looking on a city.
Just a few years later, less benign commissioners of the king found their way to Bury. Their search for riches was literal, not literary. They left Bury as a series of extraordinary ruins that seemed more like the product of some natural disaster.
What's for certain is that he would have wept were he to see what we see before us now.
James Simpson, Professor of Medieval Literature at Harvard.
We see columns of stone beaten as if by the sea, but only after looking at them for a little while do we understand and see that they are in fact humanly crafted columns. They're clearly the fillers for what had been the main pillars of a great abbey church. The destruction of Bury happened with remarkable rapidity. We have letters by people commissioned to destroy the abbeys sent to Cromwell, who administered the Court of Augmentations. One letter sent in 1538 says that, "Have been at St. Edmund's Bury, where we found a rich shrine, very cumbrous to deface. Having taken in the monastery over 5,000 marks in gold and silver, besides a rich cross with emeralds and stones of great value. Today, we depart towards Ely."
The destruction is a complicated business, isn't it? It takes a lot of effort and organisation.
Destroying buildings of this size was no easy business. But one thing we can be sure of is that the fate of books was of little consequence when so much material goods were to be gained in this massive transfer of land and property, the largest such transfer of land in England since the Norman Conquest. The Protestant bibliographer John Bale lamented in 1549 about the terrible destruction and loss of monastic library holdings. Bale was no friend to monasteries, but he was certainly a great friend to their books, and he complains that many of the new owners of the monasteries, that's to say people in the Tudor ascendancy, reserved of those library books some to serve their jakes, that's to say their toilets, some to scour their candlesticks, and some to rub their boots. Some they sold to the gracers and the soap sellers, and some they sent over the sea to the bookbinders, not in small number, to the wondering of the foreign nations.
So medieval manuscripts just become a source of spare leather, if you like.
Spare leather, some to scour their candlesticks and some to rub their boots. I imagine that medieval manuscripts may have been used to wrap fish in.
Such events must have anguished Leyland. The gentle bookworm becomes harbinger of vandals, iconoclasts, and destroyers of texts. But spoliation was always latent in Leyland's commission. The king and Thomas Cromwell wanted to know what the monasteries had and what could be had from them. Leyland's book listing was clearly not entirely innocent, and as early as 1534, before the full force of dissolution destructiveness was unleashed, we find him precociously involved in an act of iconoclasm. This is reported in a letter to Thomas Cromwell.
As Master Leyland and I did walk in the Cathedral Church of York, he perceived a table hanging upon the wall within the said church, and there found represented the reign of diverse kings of this realm, among which he found one line of a king that took the kingdom of the Pope by tribute to hold of the Church of Rome, which I cut out of the said table and raised the same, and herein I send you the title thereof as it was in the said table. Your servant, George Lawson.
This table no longer hangs in York Minster, but may still be found in a dark corner of the Minster Library.
So, well, that's like a diptych, isn't it, with parchment in the middle?
It is, actually. It is, that's right. It's like opening up a sort of piece of history in front of your eyes.
I gazed upon this astonishing relic of fractious times with its iconoclastic slash in the parchment in the company of historian Bill Shields.
And look, you can see it here, that gap on the third column of this kind of four-column parchment account backed onto that wooden frame, which must have been quite a staggering piece of, as it were, iconoclasm in front of the Minster clergy at this febrile time in British politics for an outsider, a royal man from Berwick, plus a royal official, if you like, from London coming up and taking apart one of their treasured documents. They took that piece out because classically, in the controversy over papal power, the reign of King John was one of those central sort of features, as was, I suppose, Becket as well. But the papacy had placed England under an interdict during John's reign, and John had to show obedience to the Pope to remove that papal interdict. So it was a classic case of English royal power accepting that it emanated from papal imperial authority. So that's why it was so important at this time.
And you can really read the future from that great slash, can't you? You know, today the document, tomorrow the monasteries. So this does align Leyland the book lover with more aggressive commissioners.
I think it does, actually. They are executors of royal policy, as well as, in Leyland's case, a disinterested scholarly searcher out.
Resistance to Henry's commissioners was especially strong in Yorkshire, where a full-scale rising was led by a local lawyer, Robert Aske. This pilgrimage of grace saw some 20,000 rebels march on York in October 1536. Thousands of them processed singing down the aisle at York Minster, carrying banners of Christ crucified and wearing pilgrim badges.
Christ crucified, Christ crucified, for thy wounds wide as common sky, which pilgrims me.
Leyland's bookish travels suddenly seemed more difficult to distinguish.